Hey everybody, welcome to the Viscast. We are taking a short break from our series on the historical Jesus to talk about what has happened to the Palestinians living in Gaza. Obviously, we've been following this closely and we wanted to give you our thoughts. As you can imagine, we are disturbed and saddened by the deaths and injuries of thousands of Palestinians. We give a bit of background on the protests and on Gaza in general. And then we give our commentary on the events, including thoughts on Israeli society and a bit on the role of the Bible in all of this. We will devote another full episode to our views on the role of the Bible in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Thanks as always for listening, and please recommend and share this episode with others. So we want to devote this podcast episode to what is happening in Gaza and in Israel in general, because there's also the move of the embassy, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and that is playing a critical role in what is happening in Gaza and what has been happening over the last month and a half. So the context is that since March 30, over the course of about a month and a half, Gazans have been regularly, Palestinians who live in Gaza have been regularly protesting at the border in various places, but the border between Israel and Gaza. And border is not even actually the most perfect term for it, because there are no recognized borders of Gaza and between Gaza and Israel. Same goes for the West Bank. There are no internationally recognized borders. These are armistice lines, meaning lines that were drawn when a ceasefire took place in 48, and then again, the lines are from 48, and they continue after 1967 when Israel occupied both Gaza and the West Bank. So they're called the Green Line in the West Bank that separates the West Bank from Israel. And it's because they were actually drawn with a green pen at the time in 1949. And so you hear people talk about the Green Line. And they're armistice lines, really going back to the end of the 48-49 war between the surrounding Arab countries and Israel. So they are protesting, Palestinians who live in Gaza are protesting the Israeli blockade, in part, of Gaza, though the name of the protest is the March of Return. And what is that about? Return to where? Where are Palestinians living in Gaza? Where are they wanting to return to? Is probably a question some of you might have.
So, right of return is a major issue for all Palestinians, but in particular the Palestinians of Gaza. In 1948, during the war between what was then Jewish armed folks and the Arab countries around them, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt. There were 750,000 people driven off their land. 450 villages were either destroyed or reoccupied by Jewish folks, many of them, most of them from Europe, a lot of them coming out of the Holocaust. And these folks went somewhere. Some of them went to Nazareth. Many of them went to Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan.
And these are Palestinians.
And these are Palestinians, thank you. And Gaza. In fact, 70% of the occupants in the Gaza Strip are internal refugees. Mm-hmm. In other words, they come from villages that are no longer there or are occupied now by Jewish Israelis.
And some of them, you know, we're now getting on in years, some of them were actually driven out, and then the others of them, to make up 70%, are descendants of people who were driven out and still consider themselves refugees.
That's 70
rightfully
years.
So.
In 70 years. So we're talking about at least third generation, and even beyond that for little kids, little children that are. So right of return is a Palestinian doctrine that has always been a part of their negotiations, that they, any kind of treaty or any kind of peace deal between them and Israel would allow them to return to the homes they were driven from. Now, that means right of return for all Palestinian refugees, and there are now millions, if you think about the descendants and where they've all gone. And so right of return is in principle, the right for Palestinians who have driven from their villages to return to these villages and reclaim what was theirs. Now, it has become largely symbolic. The Palestinians know this. Israelis know this. Anyone who's involved in the negotiations know this. But it's a very significant symbol that is connected to the Nakba, or the catastrophe, which is what they call what happened in 1948 when the Arab forces were defeated by the then armed Jewish forces, and they were driven from their land. They call that the Nakba, or the catastrophe. And so return, or right of return, becomes a symbol that is connected in memory and in consciousness and in their hearts to what happened to them, the trauma that still is with them that happened when they were defeated back in 1948. And then I'll just say this and then pass it back to you, Josh. But then also in 1967, the Six-Day War, because a significant number of the refugees in Gaza were driven out later from villages and from other places later in 67 as well, and ended up in Gaza.
And the right of return is a right under international law. This isn't something that is only a desire of Palestinians that has no basis in international law. Any conflict now around the world that ends up driving people away from their homes. And so you can think of places currently like Syria where people have to flee. They're not actually a part of the armed conflict. They're just people living in a place where armed conflict is taking place. This is the case for many, many, many of the Palestinians. They just fled away from a conflict zone. They weren't fighting and then fled. They were caught in between armies because there Palestinians, some of them joined the Arab forces, but many of them were not trained in any way. They were peasants who were either selling wares in various markets, but most of them were farmers. And so they were caught in between, basically, and fled, many of them to Gaza, some to the West Bank as well. So I think under international law, since most of this comes out of World War II, the right of those peoples who are driven off their land in an armed conflict is that they should be able to return to their lands. And that is true now as it was then. So in Syria, that should be true for them as well. Now, it doesn't always work out, but I just wanted to be clear that this is an internationally recognized right that Palestinians are asserting. Now, as we said, most of these people were driven off lands that are now in the modern state of Israel, and basically nobody thinks that any significant number of them, and at this point I would say none of them, are going to be actually allowed to return to lands that are now in the modern state of Israel. The main reason being that Israel does not want a demographic problem on their hands, meaning 5 million Palestinians become Israeli citizens and suddenly there are now more Palestinian Israelis than Jewish Israelis, and how do you then have a Jewish state in which you're not the majority? But right of return, because it's an internationally recognized right under international law, goes into the negotiations on a two-state solution, which is there any two-state solution? That's for another day, but that's becoming increasingly unclear, is rightfully a part of those negotiations. And generally, the conversation is around maybe some, a small, a very small minority would be able to return to places in Israel, increasingly unlikely, but that they would be able to return to what became Palestine, so Gaza or the West Bank, for people who are not in there, in those places now. And often what's discussed is some sort of reparations.
Right.
And I will add just one last thing on that. Israel received reparations from Germany. This is not unprecedented. Millions of dollars. I don't have the number on me, but I know they did. So the idea of receiving reparations for a wrong done to you is also not unprecedented.
So this was called the March of Return. It is, as I said, it is really bringing up into the Palestinian consciousness the trauma of the Nakba, the catastrophe. It is a reminder to Israel and to other Palestinians all over the world that they have not returned, that they are still in Gaza. It is also driven from a hopelessness, a despair, out of living conditions that are deplorable. Gaza is 25 miles long and about 3 or 4 miles wide at its widest point, 144 square miles. 1.8 million people are crammed into that. The infrastructure is such that only 10% have good drinking water, that most others are polluted by waste because the waste management system does not exist, has been destroyed in multiple conflicts with Israel, bombed. They aren't allowed to bring material in to fix it because that material is tubular, and that's a problem for Israel because of rockets and all of that kind of thing, so they limit what they can bring in. You have 46% unemployment. You've got a high percentage of Gazans that are under the age of 25.
So amongst those under 25, 64% are unemployed. And 60% of Palestinians living in Gaza are under the age of 18. 40% are under the age of 14.
The UN has said in their official documents and just recently that by the year 2020, Gaza will basically be uninhabitable. Now, there's going to be people living there. But the conditions will be such that if it were any other territory, it would be declared by health officials and folks who are involved in geography and geology and all of these kinds of sciences as uninhabitable, meaning you can't sustain life there. And now, I want to add one other caveat, 144 square miles, but 17% of Gaza lies between the two barriers. You have a barbed wire barrier that goes on the north and west side, and then you have a fence that is sensitized for if there are infiltrations, it will sense that and let you know. And in between there is a no man's land that makes up 17% of that 144 square miles. And some of that is their best agricultural land. So, you know, to add insult to injury, the barrier itself takes away land that Gazans could use to be self-sustaining.
They have about, the average is 4 hours of electricity a day. Now, you might be thinking, you probably have gotten some idea of Israel's role in this, but Often it is cited that Israel disengaged from Gaza in 2005, and therefore any problems that are happening in Gaza are now the fault of Gazans, and particularly Hamas. We're not going to spend any time defending Hamas, but you need to know that since 2007, so now 10 years on, more than 10 years, Israel has been has put in place a blockade that includes land, air, and sea. So that is Israel's role in this, in Gaza, and in the suffering in Gaza by sea. They put 3 to 6 nautical miles is as far as Gazans can go out in the Mediterranean. Sometimes it gets extended to 9. That's rare. It's really 6 nautical miles and beyond where the sardines are found, and that has been traditionally one of Gazan's main fishing, one of the main fish that they fish for. So the fishing industry has been hurt badly by this 10-year blockade. You have the air space in Gaza is controlled by Israel. There are no airports. All of the borders are basically controlled by Israel. There's a southern border with Egypt, but Israel's made it clear that Egypt basically does what Israel says it wants done at that border. So Egypt does not offer any significant relief to Gazans. So is there anything more to add on Israel's control there? No. So anything coming in and out of Gaza is controlled entirely by Israel. That's the key thing to know. Anything coming in and out, the population registry controlled by Israel. You have a baby born, you have to register it with Israel to get an ID card. To get a Palestinian ID card, you have to register that child with Israel. If you have a medical condition and the hospitals are not sufficient for most major medical conditions in Gaza, how do you get to a better hospital in the West Bank? You have to get a permit from Israel to leave. And those permits have gone down considerably over the last 10 years. They wax and wane depending on situations. But the idea that, the reason this is important is the idea that Gazans should somehow be held responsible for the conditions within Gaza is absurd. They do not have the independence you need within Gaza, including their borders, which is a big key, but even developing within Gaza, let alone getting things in and out, to build a sustainable economy in any way, shape, or form. I mean, 4 hours of electricity, how do you have a plant that makes anything, for example?
Well, and then the argument that it's their own fault if they would just submit to Israel's authority, if they wouldn't fire rockets out of Gaza into Israel, if they wouldn't fight back in any way, then by some benevolent means, Israel would take care of them or allow them to prosper. There have been months where Gazans have not done anything that could be remotely considered to be aggressive or violent, and their conditions have not improved. So the idea that if they just submit, which is what you hear all the time, it's their own fault. If they just submit and stop firing rockets, they've done that. They've tried that. Palestinians have tried that over and over and over and over again. And the fact of the matter is that simply is not true. That is not the case. So what we have in this march of return, we have the mention of return to remind Palestinians, West Bank and others, and other Arabs, that they are not on the property that belongs to them in their view, that they are refugees. It comes out of desperation, comes out of hopelessness. And what they're doing, it started in January where a journalist went out, pitched a tent. That's where it started. It then developed into what it is now with Hamas organizing what Hamas has claimed to be a nonviolent movement. Of course, there's no controlling the young men there. And so it hasn't purely been nonviolent, but by and large, it has.
Mm-hmm.
And what you had then is, 30 to 100,000, more like between 20 and 50, or even more like 20,000 Gazans who are moving, marching towards the first fence, the barbed wire fence, and Israel's snipers have shot and killed over 100 and wounded with rubber bullets and live ammunition and grenade or tear gas canisters, mm-hmm. and well, now near 10,000. This is according to Doctors Without Borders. This is not just the internal reckoning of Gaza, but Doctors Without Borders is confirming both the death count and the wounded. So this is what's happening. And I'll just let you add how Israel is done in this whole thing.
Yeah, and it should be noted that what they are doing is really gathering by the fence. Not all marching in unison at the fence to try to tear it down. There's been very little of that. So I just don't want people to get the impression that, 20,000 people were trying to break down the fence. That's what this looked like. It didn't look like that. Mostly it looked like people gathering by the fence, sometimes burning tires, showing their displeasure. And in terms of Israeli casualties, zero. Israeli injuries, zero. So you have 100 deaths to zero deaths. You have 100 injuries. Sorry, 100 deaths to zero, and you have 5 to 10,000 injuries to zero injuries. I think those numbers speak for themselves.
From Israel's point of view, because I mean, you can hear by the tone and by what we're presenting that our sympathies are with the Gazans and especially the innocent folks, and most of the people that have been shot and killed and wounded are innocent folks. Our sympathies are with them, so we're not going to try and hide that or pretend that. However, there is another side, and from Israel's point of view, these are a people, 30,000 people, who are approaching a border, a fence, and who are claiming themselves that they want to march through, that they want to be on the other side. And so you have soldiers who are looking at 30,000 people, and that's a lot of people. And so what are they to do? You know, what alternatives do they have? But to shoot to kill or shoot to wound or to keep these hordes of people from coming into Israel and raising havoc. I mean, that's from Israel's point of view, and it needs to be stated, I don't have an answer to what their alternative is, right? I mean, there's lots of alternatives they could choose, I suppose. But from their perspective, this is their right to defend their border, and they have no choice. That they're not the ones who have started this, the Gazans have, and they have no choice but to respond in kind.
I would say this. If a person is not actively trying to cross over the border, cut away to the border, you know, cut away the fence or climb over it, they should not be shot with live ammunition. I would say that I don't know who would argue with that. And I will tell you that absolutely 10,000 people have not tried to do that. I would guess not even 1,000 have tried to do that. But it's hard to get numbers on these kinds of things. I can't give them to you. But I would say, let's just start there. If you're not actively trying to come over the fence, you should not be shot with live ammunition. I think you could even argue, even in that case, you don't need live ammunition. Most of the time, if you're a police officer or you are a military person in this case, and you are dealing with civilians, you do not use lethal force unless your life is being put in danger. Even an unarmed Palestinian climbing over the fence is not putting anybody's life in danger. So they are treating, and they have said this themselves, they are treating all the Palestinians gathering there as enemy combatants, all of them, weapons or no weapons. And that is a crazy, crazy, what am I looking for? War engagement of war, war terms. It's a crazy way to define it. But that's what they've done. So I would say there are lots of ways they could have done it differently, but from their perspective, they feel as though it had to be. Rules of engagement, that's what I was looking for. That's right. The rules of engagement they've chosen. Human rights organizations within Israel have challenged them on this, and it's still sort of to be determined, but most of it's done now.
So let's think about that a little bit biblically and, you know, theologically. You know, what we are into now in our world is the world of the strong man, the world of the powerful, the world of military, the world of lethal force. So our first response to any kind of threat to us is violence. And there is biblical precedence for violence being a response to conflict, but it's not the Jesus story. So I don't know what the alternative is, and I'm not going to pretend that I do, but there has to be a better one. From a Christian point of view, there has to be a better alternative than shooting down, murdering people who are without weapons, wounding people who are without weapons. There simply has to be a more moral Christian, Jewish, a better moral Christian, Jewish response than violence. And I will quote now my good friend Rami Elkanan, who, when asked for solutions, says there are solutions that are obvious and apparent and on the table. And all we ask, Rami Elkanan lost a daughter in the conflict, all we ask is that you choose one that doesn't kill people. And so, you know, from a biblical theological perspective, rather than try and answer that question, because there is no answer, any answer I give, somebody is going to shoot down. I'm just going to say there's got to be a better alternative than violence.
I would say that the Bible offers you a variety of choices, including the New Testament, though the New Testament is, by and large, gives you less violent choices than the Old Testament. But the truth of the Bible is it's quite diverse. We all know we can go. Genocide is a biblical template that exists in the Bible. It's in Joshua. And the idea is the Israelites should go in and take the land of Canaan. And it's asserted as important that they eradicate the Canaanites there. So if somebody were to say to me, is genocide biblical? I would say, yes, it absolutely is biblical. If you want to include it in the plethora of choices you choose to think about for the way in which Jews and Christians in this case want to decide conflicts, you can include it. Most of the time, I find people don't care for that option, thankfully, but there it is.
It is an option we chose in terms of our Indian population, and it was a biblical supported option that this was like the Canaanites, and they needed to be eradicated. A bounty was put on their heads, men, woman, or child. Every scalp was worth a certain amount of money. They brought blankets infected with smallpox. The idea was to eradicate that entire population group, and it was supported by the Bible, as was slavery. I'm just saying that you're exactly right. We can choose the interpretation we want to justify whatever action we want to take, which is what's happening right now in Israel-Palestine.
Yeah.
And we're speaking out against that. We're saying there are better options to choose from, better biblical options to choose from than this.
There are absolutely better options. Let me say something about God gave this land to, promised this land to Abraham, repeated the promise to Isaac and to Jacob. There are places in Genesis 13, 15, those chapters where that promise is eternal. Therefore, end of conversation for some people. And what happens is, typically, you either don't talk about what the consequences of those actions are in the current context, or you demonize the people for whom the consequences are dire and terrible. And that's what's happening with Gaza, right? So if you're a Christian, and they're often referred to as Christian Zionists, and all that means is, just basically anyways, it means people who support the modern state of Israel because it sees the modern state of Israel as the fulfillment of the biblical promise of the land to Abraham. That's the simple truth. That's the basic part of Christian Zionism. And that is biblical. The promise of the land in the Old Testament is central. The choosing of this one people group amongst all people groups to be God's favorite, and then to give that people group a piece of land that at the time was occupied by other people, and so God helped them violently take it. That's crucial to the story of the Old Testament, whether we like it or not. And I don't particularly like it. There are no parts of that that I particularly like. God favoring one people group over others. God giving one people group a group of land that another people group already had, and then God helping them violently take it and kill that people group. I don't like any of those things. But I'm not going to say to you or to anyone, well, that's a gross misreading of the Old Testament. It's not. That's a straightforward reading of the Old Testament. The promise of the land is critical. And so what happens in this context with Gaza is they say, they don't do it. It's always a little bit roundabout, right? There's enough discomfort, thankfully. There's a little bit of discomfort with the killing of Palestinians. So they don't just say God gave the land to Israel. They need to eradicate the Palestinians like they did the Canaanites. End of story. I don't find very many people, no matter how committed they are to supporting the modern state of Israel, who say it quite that bluntly. What do they do instead? Well, they assert the superiority of Israeli society and of Israelis, Jewish Israelis particularly, because there are Palestinian Israelis, and then they denigrate Palestinian people. They talk about how, look how after 1948, when Israel took it, they made the land flourish, and the Palestinians couldn't do that before 1948. And then now in this context, that's just one example, in this context they say, those people in Gaza deserve what they're getting. Why? Well, they shouldn't be there on the border doing those really threatening acts, right? What did they expect? Or they're all affiliated with Hamas. Therefore, Hamas, every single person who's in any way affiliated with Hamas is a terrorist, and so Israel is right to kill them. Or, and they may not say this outright, but this is often the case in this, they're Muslims. That's a terrible religion. They're dangerous. So they're all terrorists just by virtue of the fact that most of them are Muslims. These are the things that the worst of Christian Zionists do. But even your sort of average Christian Zionist typically finds a way to say Israel is justified in almost anything. And the way they're justified is either they're superior, and usually what's added is the Palestinians are deserving of what's happening to them because of their cultural inferiority, because they're Muslim, and because they're violent terrorists.
the other, what we've heard many, many times when we lived there and when we traveled there, is Jewish Israelis, and in particular soldiers, who will say to us that Palestinians, and by the way, settlers have said this to us too, as well, and they mean it as a joke, but they don't.
Say what a settler is real quick.
A settler is someone who is Jewish Israeli and is occupying land in the West Bank or East Jerusalem or the Golan Heights, all of which are disputed territories by international law.
And up until 2005, there were about 8,000 settlers in Gaza, but they were withdrawn.
That's right. And so you have about 500,000 to 600,000 settlers who live somewhere in wonderful gated communities with all the water they need. And again, you can hear by my tone that there's a discrimination that happens in the allotment of water and other resources to these folks, which makes it almost impossible for Palestinian farmers to compete.
And settlements are illegal under international law. You cannot move your private citizens into occupied territory.
Right. So what I've heard them say, they quote the Bible by saying the Palestinians, Arabs, all Arabs, they won't use the word Palestinians, by the
way. That's
right. You'll very seldom hear an Israeli Jewish person talk about Palestinians. They always use the word Arab because there is no such thing as a Palestinian. There is no such thing as Palestine. There never was. So therefore, they're Arabs. And that's another way to denigrate them, but also to refuse their identity.
That's right.
They don't have an identity. But what they will say is they're descendants from Ishmael. And then they'll quote this passage, and Ishmael was a wild ass of a man. And when they say that, they'll chuckle, and then they'll go, and that's true, too. What are they saying? They're superior. It's a racist comment that comes out of a heart that believes they're better than. And by the way, Jewish Israelis aren't the only folks who think they're superior by race.
And not all Jewish Israelis are like this, but increasingly so in Israeli society. Israeli society is becoming increasingly right-winged. The left, the movement on the left has been just decimated over the last, say, 15 to 20 years. But there is a real racism in Israeli society.
Oh,
that is just without question.
It's blatant. It's blatant. And, I'm not even going to hedge on words there. It is blatantly racist. Even dark-skinned Jewish people are treated worse than, and I don't mean just in terms of where they can live, the jobs they get, simply because they're darker-skinned.
And they're Jewish Israelis.
They're Jewish Israelis, but they're darker skinned. And they have protested in Tel Aviv. The point, getting back to the point of if you're going to go to your Bible now, because we want to stay on biblical theology, and you're going to determine by your Bible that there's a people group favored by God, it's a pretty small leap to not think of yourself as not just favored, but better than. And you can pretend you haven't made that leap, and you can use language, which I hear all the time, which is pious language. Oh, yeah, but we weren't chosen because we were better. We were chosen because we were the least, and we're blessed to be a blessing and all of that. But that does not translate into reality.
And what happens in Israeli society, what has happened in Israeli society, and for a variety of reasons, is your average Israeli has become desensitized to the suffering of Palestinians. So you might wonder, like, how does an average Israeli feel about what happened that their soldiers, trained snipers, were gunning down people on the other side of two fences, hitting them in the leg sometimes, but when they killed them in the chest or head, right? Aiming to kill. They killed over 100 and they, like we said, wounded 5 to 10,000. How does the average Israeli feel about that? They must feel some guilt or shame or discomfort. What has happened, and I would say it's this, so what I described that Christian Zionists do, many Israelis have done. They have decided that these people are deserving of what's happening to them for a variety of reasons, the ones I named. Often it's Hamas, and end of story. These are sympathizers of Hamas. So therefore, what's happening to them, they deserve. And then there's no sympathy within Israeli society for it. And so they're just desensitized to what their country is doing to the Palestinian people.
And we might think again, because hopefully you're seeing that there's a connection here to the way the Bible is read and interpreted, but also our own experience and our own fears and our own prejudice. You might think about when a young black man is gunned down by police in our country, what is our first thought? He did something deserving of this. He did something wrong. He's to blame. And there are times when, of course, he is. But this comes out of our own, how we were raised, our own socialization, right? All of that. And this is similar to what we see and feel in Israel among Jewish Israelis, too, is that there's this feeling that if something happens to a Palestinian, they deserved it.
Absolutely.
No matter what it is.
Yeah, we're in this process now in the United States of not being able, really being confronted with the suffering of African-American males within the United States with this systemic racism. And you can see the struggle in our society amongst mainly white people to reckon with that, to deal with that. And you have people really reacting in very different ways.
But the good news is we're struggling with it. The bad news in Israel, there's no struggle.
Yeah,
basically, there's no struggle.
Yeah, that's right. I think here there's a process that is maybe leading to some healing and recognition. They are really going in the other direction in Israel, I would say. And all of this is, you know, anecdotal, though much of what I read agrees with it. So it's not just our own anecdotal experience, but they're turning more to the right. And the right cares about security and borders and supports settlements and annexation of all of Jerusalem, which they've already done. But the idea that they would never go back on that and give East Jerusalem to the Palestinians. This is where Israeli society is heading. And what that means is increasingly you can do worse and worse things to regular innocent Palestinians without Israeli society being bothered. Thanks so much for listening. Please recommend this episode to others, and stay tuned for another episode of the Viscast next week.